This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 77 to 78 of chapter Al-Hajj from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. يا أيها الذين آمنوا اركعوا واسجدوا واعبدوا ربكم وافعلوا الخير لعلكم تفلحون يا أيها الذين آمنوا اركعوا واسجدوا واعبدوا ربكم وافعلوا الخير لعلكم تفلحون وجاهدوا في الله حق جهاده هو اجتباكم وما جعل عليكم في الدين من حرج ملة أبيكم إبراهيم وَسَمَّاكُمُ الْمُسْلِمِينَ مِنْ قَبْلُ وَفِي هَذَا لِيَكُونَ الرَّسُولُ شَهِيدًا عَلَيْكُمْ وَتَكُونُوا شُهَدَاءَ عَلَى النَّاسِ وَسَمَّاكُمُ الْمُسْلِمِينَ مِنْ قَبْلُ وَفِي هَذَا لِيَكُونَ الرَّسُولُ شَهِيدًا عَلَيْكُمْ وتكونوا شهداء على الناس فأقيموا الصلاة وآتوا الزكاة واعتصموا بالله هو مولاكم فنعم المولى ونعم النصير صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. O you who believe, bow down and prostrate yourselves and serve your Lord and do good that you may succeed.
and strive hard in the way of Allah, such striving as is due to Him. He has chosen you and has not laid upon you any hardship in religion. The faith of your father Ibrahim, he named you Muslims before, and in this, that the apostle may be a bearer of witness to you, and you may be bearers of witness to the people. Therefore, keep up prayer and pay the poor rate, and hold fast by Allah. He is your guardian. How excellent the guardian, and how excellent the helper.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The death toll in a suicide bombing that tore through a mosque in Pakistan's Peshawar rises to 87. Iran warns against any aggression on its territory, vowing a decisive response that will make enemies regret their actions. Also ahead, France is bracing for major transport disruptions with mass strikes and protests set to hit the country for the second time in a month. Our top story this hour, the death toll from a suicide bombing in the northwestern Pakistan keeps rising. Officials have confirmed at least 87 deaths so far. The blast took place in a crowded mosque in the city of Peshawar in a highly fortified security compound. It also left scores of others injured. Many of the casualties are police officers who had gathered for noon prayers. Some are in critical condition. No one has claimed responsibility yet. Pakistan has been facing a resurgence of violent attacks in recent months. Most of them have been claimed by a militant group known as Tehreek-e-Taliban-e-Pakistan. Kamran Yusuf is our correspondent in the Pakistani capital, Islamabad, and joins us now. Kamran, so we're seeing this rising death toll in Peshawar. What's the latest that you're hearing on the ground there?
Well, the latest is that the death toll is rising. The latest figure is that now authorities have confirmed that 93 people have so far died in this horrific attack and over 150 injured. This death toll may further rise as some of the injured are said to be in critical condition. Meanwhile, a rescue operation is still underway. As you know, that the impact of the blast was so huge that the portion of the building collapsed, trapping people underneath. And rescue workers are trying to go through the debris if there were any people alive under it. A day after this tragic incident, it is a day of mourning in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province. The Pakistani flag is flying half-mast on all the buildings. And now the key question is that who was behind this incident, as there have been conflicting reports earlier. One of the commanders of the Pakistani Taliban claimed responsibility, but later the Pakistani Taliban denied their involvement. So questions are being asked that who was really behind this incident.
Right, Kamran, and we know it was a highly fortified security compound, which raises the question about the security apparatus there in the Peshawar.
Indeed, I think this mosque, which was located inside police headquarters, not only police headquarters, but it also houses the counter-terrorism department of the province. So that place was considered one of the safest places in the cities, and you had to go through several security checks to enter that safe zone. And that was the reason that even the country's prime minister, who visited Peshawar last night soon after this tragic incident, asked questions from the police chief that how could a terrorist manage to enter that high security zone. At the moment, authorities had no answer. The country's defense minister did not rule out the possibility of some inside job, or some police officials might have facilitated the suicide bomber. So certainly these are critical questions that authorities need to answer, that how a terrorist managed to enter in a high security zone.
Kamran, thank you very much indeed for that. Kamran Yusuf is our correspondent, joining us live from Islamabad. Elsewhere, Iran has warned against any aggression on the country, vowing a decisive response that will make enemies regret their actions. The warning follows anti-Iran rhetoric by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. In an interview, the top U.S. diplomat rehashed allegations against Iran's nuclear program, saying all options remain on the table to stop Iran acquiring an atomic weapon. Now, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman says the U.S. is well aware that Iran will not tolerate any aggression against its territory and interests. Nasser Kanani called on U.S. authorities to beware of the legal, international and political consequences of such provocative statements. He once again underscored the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear program, but added that the country will not stop its nuclear advances as a party to the non-proliferation treaty. Palestinians have held a funeral for a young man killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry says 26-year-old Nayaf Salman Abu Fawda was shot in the head at the entrance of the city of Al Khalil. The shooting comes just days after the regime's forces launched a deadly raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the West Bank. The incursion left 10 Palestinians dead and dozens more injured. Israel has stepped up its crackdown across the occupied territories. 35 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank this year so far. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, has given us more details about the killing of the young Palestinian in Al Khalil.
Circumstances of killing yet another Palestinian in Al Khalil this time, it's not clear. What we know is that a 26-year-old Nassim Abu Fawda arrived at the Israeli military checkpoint known as 160. It's south Al-Ibrahimi, Al-Haram Al-Ibrahimi, in the city of Al Khalil. He arrived there and Israeli forces opened fire. They shot him directly in the head. He was transferred to hospital and immediately he died in the Palestinian hospital in Al Khalil. The Israeli military didn't issue any statements yet to say, as usual, that a Palestinian tried to carry out an anti-Israeli operation or to stab Israeli soldiers or to shoot Israeli soldiers. As usual, many justifications and excuses. What we received is that a Palestinian man arrived at a military checkpoint and he was shot dead.
In other news, France is bracing for travel chaos as workers are to stage mass rallies and walkouts in protest against the government's contested pension reform plan. Intercity travel and subway services in Paris are expected to be the worst affected sectors. Education sector staff are also set to join the industrial unrest. Workers will hit the streets nationwide, with the turnout expected to stand at around 1 million. The action is the second countrywide strike in France in a month. This is in response to the government's reform bill to overhaul the pension system and raise retirement age by 2 years. The National Assembly started examining the proposals on Monday. The government needs to win over Conservatives in Parliament to get the bill passed and has ruled out the possibility of backpedaling on the plan. UK firefighters, meanwhile, have joined a long list of workers to vote for a nationwide strike over a pay dispute with the government. The Fire Brigades Union says it has given the government 10 days to come up with an improved offer after rejecting a 5% pay rise in November. Any walkout would be the first national strike by firefighters over pay since 2003. The firefighters' ultimatum will mount more pressure on the government. Workers in various sectors, including nurses, lawyers, train drivers and teachers, have already staged the strikes over the past months. They are demanding better pay rises as double-digit inflation squeezes household budgets. British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has sacked the chairman of the ruling Conservative Party after his adviser concluded that Nadeem Zahawi breached the ministerial code over tax affairs. The dismissal puts under the spotlight the fact that how the UK ministers over the years have put their interest above national interest.
While the British public is grappling with an unprecedented cost of living crisis, the dismissal of a high-ranking Tory official has added insult to the injury of millions of Britons. That after it emerged that chairman of the Conservative Party, Nadeem Zahawi, paid a penalty to HM Revenue and Customs over previously unpaid tax as part of a multi-million pound dispute while he was Chancellor. HM Revenue and Customs is a non-ministerial department of the UK government responsible for collecting taxes. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak was quick to react to save his party from yet another scandal. He fired Zahawi for what he called serious breaches of the ministerial code over his tax affairs. An investigation by Sunak's ethics advisor concluded that Zahawi had broken the rules by repeatedly failing to declare an HMRC probe into his tax affairs. The dispute concluded with a £5 million settlement, including a penalty. But on Sunday, Sunak sent a letter to Zahawi saying his ethic advisor had concluded there was, quote, a serious breach of the ministerial code. In the letter, Sunak also announced his removal from the post. The dismissal came as Sunak was under fire himself for initially standing by Zahawi before ordering an internal investigation. But the Premier defended his stance, arguing that integrity in politics was the reason he did not sack the Tory chairman in time.
I think that's the right thing to do, to ensure that we have integrity in politics, but to do that in a professional way, that's what we're doing.
But many Britons remain unsatisfied with Sunak's handling of the issue. They reason out that the Prime Minister, who acted within hours over his advisor's report, should have sacked Zahawi earlier.
Well, Nadeem Zahawi obviously should be thinking about his future, but I think the bigger question here is why the Prime Minister didn't act earlier, what he knew about this situation, and why he seems to be continuously putting the interests of his party above those of his country. He knew there were allegations about Zahawi for a long time. He then knew that Zahawi had been negotiating a deal with HMRC at the same time as he was in charge of HMRC as the Chancellor. So I think the biggest question today isn't actually for Zahawi, it's actually for the Prime Minister.
Sunak also faces scrutiny over whether he knew about the minister's tax affairs and when he was told there could be a reputational risk to the government after Zahawi's appointment in October. Now many, including former high-ranking officials, suggest that Sunak's premiership risks being brought down by scandals swirling around the Tories. One such is high-stakes parliamentary inquiry into whether Sunak's predecessor Boris Johnson misled lawmakers over Partygate.
Well, Zahawi's dismissal comes at a time the UK is grappling with an unprecedented cost of living crisis. The record high inflation has prompted workers from various sectors to stage mass walkouts in recent weeks and months. They are demanding better working conditions as well as wages in line with inflation.
The sacking of Nadeem Zahawi comes as Sanaa's government, facing decades-high inflation and a wave of public sector strike, while trailing badly in opinion polls ahead of an expected 2024 election. To many, the tax evasion of Zahawi has not come as a surprise. But for a prime minister who promised accountability, professionalism and integrity while taking office, this is just a disgrace. But what happens when governments, especially in so-called first-world countries, are submerged in corruption? Many argue that politics in those countries are too chaotic to the point where things get out of hand, like what happened in the case of Zahawi. So the ironic situation is when a man briefly in charge of the treasury does not pay taxes himself while insisting that others must pay. Apart from that, the UK is already grappling with a cost of living crisis which has been unprecedented in a century. This, coupled with the skyrocketing inflation, have so far prompted hundreds of thousands of workers from various sectors, including railway, postal, dock, energy and medical, to stage walkouts over pay and working conditions. While workers' union accuse the government of inaction and call for talks to resolve the disputes, workers want their pay in line with the inflation that is currently at the level of nearly 11%. The UK is also facing rampant food and energy costs. Some even struggle to make ends meet or even afford to put food on the table.
There's people around here who can't afford to put clothes on their kids' backs or food on their table, and that he has mistakenly missed an error.
Charities are stocking up duvets, sleeping bags, hot water bottles, and blankets because they know that people can't afford to heat their homes anymore. That puts in the spotlight the number of governments which one after another took the helm at number 10 and attempted to resolve the cost of living crisis, but to no avail. The much bigger question is that how can the Sunak government run the country when it is unable to cope with this and other crises happening over there?
After much dispute and wrangling over the delivery of advanced tanks to Ukraine, Western leaders are showing signs of even deeper divisions over the supply of fighter jets to the country. US President Joe Biden and German Chancellor Olaf Scholz have both categorically dismissed the idea of sending the aircraft. This is while French President Emmanuel Macron has refused to rule out sending fighter jets to Ukraine if Kiev makes such a request. The Dutch foreign minister also told lawmakers earlier this month that there were no taboos about the delivery of warplanes. Just days ago, Germany finally agreed to send its modern Leopard tanks to Ukraine after weeks of dithering and intense pressure from its allies. The US and its allies have been pouring tens of billions of dollars worth of weapons into Ukraine since the beginning of the war with Russia. The Western public, however, has grown increasingly wary of such military aid as they are forced to foot the bill amid economic hardship at home and with no end in sight to the war. Moscow has also repeatedly warned that such military aid will only prolong the war and suffering of Ukrainians. That brings an end to the International Bulletin. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless Thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
Imam Khomeini, God's righteous servant. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, these days mark the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. We have prepared a special series on this occasion. The first episode will be a brief look at Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, as the great leader of this revolution. Stay tuned, please. Imam Khomeini had been sent to exile for more than 14 years due to his struggles against the British-installed and American-supported Pahlavi regime. The Imam was sent clandestinely to Turkey in 1964. After some 10 months, He was transferred to the holy city of Najaf in Iraq. The Imam stayed in Najaf for more than 13 years, till the increase of pressures by the Shah of Iran, which forced him to change his residence from Iraq to the village of Neuf-le-Château near Paris. On February 1, 1979, Imam Khomeini's airplane took off toward Tehran. At time of entering Iran's air, a journalist asked the Imam how he felt. Imam Khomeini answered indifferently, "Nothing." Unlike the leaders of uprisings and revolutions who rejoice for triumph over their enemies, the Imam said nothing, as he had acted according to his duty and for God's sake. So he would not get sad if he failed, and he didn't become happy when he triumphed. On February 1, 1979, the greatest and most glorious welcome in history was accorded to Imam Khomeini. The axis of victory of the Islamic Revolution was surely the unmatched leader who was ably and powerfully guided the nation better than any politician in the world. While religion had been quite isolated and pushed to the margin, Imam Khomeini followed the method of the Prophet of Islam and his infallible successors to liberate a nation from the yoke of colonialists and bullies of the world. He awakened the nation and granted self-esteem, self-confidence, and identity to them and other Muslim nations. The Imam presented a new system of governance on the basis of Islam within the structure of people's vote. Here, it should be noted that people's vote played a true role in Imam's view, opposite to the flawed and backward Western democracy, which only pretends to act on the basis of people's vote, while in practice, it is at the service of the owners of power. Imam Khomeini's successor, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, describes the Imam as follows. One of the titles and epithets which have been used less about our great Imam is this phrase. We always describe the Imam with numerous epithets, but this epithet, which we have described him rarely with it, is a comprehensive epithet. He is faithful, submissive servant, and revolutionary. Faithful means that he has faith in God. He has faith in the goal. He has faith in the path that takes him to this goal. And he has faith in people. It has been mentioned in the Quran about the noble prophet too. He had faith in God. Faith in the goal, faith in the path, and faith in people. He is a servant, a submissive servant. It means that he considers himself a servant before the Lord. This is a very important epithet. Look, God, the Exalted, has praised the noble prophet with numerous epithets in the Quran, each of which mentions an ample chapter of the Prophet's characteristics. But the epithet which we Muslims have been ordered to repeat every day in our daily ritual prayers on the Prophet is this: I bear witness that indeed Muhammad is his servant and apostle. This indicates the importance of servitude. Being a servant is so prominent that God the Exalted teaches Muslims this epithet to repeat it several times in their prayers every day. The Imam had such an epithet, the epithet of servitude. He was a man of humbleness. He was a man of pleading humbly. And he was a man of praying, a submissive servant. And as for the third epithet, that is revolutionary, the Imam was the Imam of the Revolution. Imam Khomeini enjoyed a comprehensive godly personality. Therefore, upon his splendid return to the country, he opened new vistas of Islam before the contemporary man and presented Islam as a progressive religion which is capable of meeting all the demands of man in the modern world. The Iranian people had truly found their beliefs and ideals in his words and deeds. Therefore, they unanimously gathered around him. Imam Khomeini raised pure Muhammadan Islam as the new view on Islam, which includes every political, economic, cultural, and social aspect in human life. His take of Islam is a religion which fights the world oppressors and bullies in support for the oppressed and downtrodden in every country. The great leader of the Islamic Revolution believed that the way to the hereafter goes through this world. For him, both individual and social affairs mattered in order to help the individual and society grow. The Imam would never forget midnight prayer even when he was sick. On the night of flying to Tehran from Paris, while everyone was asleep, Imam Khomeini was performing midnight prayer on the upper floor of the airplane. Ayatollah Khamenei says, "What enabled the Imam to guide, administer, and lead this nation and this great revolution was his relation with God, his connection with God, his attention to God. He was truly God's servant, righteous servant. I cannot find a better epithet than this for Imam. He was a righteous servant."
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. Iran's assistance has been pivotal to the growing strength of the Palestinian resistance against the Zionist colonial occupation. And in the first part of today's programme, we'll be looking at the Islamic Republic of Iran's role in supporting the liberation of Palestine. In the second half of the show, we'll be examining how Palestine resistance factions themselves view Iran's role in their struggle for freedom. But first, we've got this special report by Latifa Abu Chakra setting out the extent to which Iran supports Palestinian liberation.
As the Palestinian resistance factions increasingly come together and take the fight to the Zionist entity, what kind of support are they getting from outside? Even its worst enemies recognise that since its establishment in 1979, the Islamic Republic of Iran has become a leading patron of the Palestinian cause. Those are the words of the Zionist front group United Against Nuclear Iran. They are quite correct. How has Iran supported the legitimate resistance of the Palestinian? Earlier this year, tens of thousands of Iranians have taken part in the annual Quds Day rallies in the capital, Tehran, in a major show of support for Palestine. Similar marches and events happen in more than 900 cities and villages nationwide, according to officials. Hossein Salami, the commander-in-chief of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC, who was the keynote speaker of the event in Tehran, told the gathering crowd that Iran's first supreme leader, Ruhollah Khomeini, established Quds Day shortly after the 1979 revolution to let the world know that Palestine was not alone. He said the current supreme leader, Ali Husseini Khamenei, subsequently established the Quds Force, the overseas arm of IRGC, to expand the Islamic revolution in other Islamic countries with the aim of pressuring the Zionist regime, and in the near future, the regime's elimination from the world's political geography. Even the Jerusalem Post recognizes the strategy being adopted by Iran of unifying the resistance, a strategy which is visibly now in operation. In the Unity Intifada of May 2021, it was revealed on the Lebanese news service Al-Manar that a joint operation room was established in Beirut in response to the Zionist attacks on Gaza. It involved officers from Hezbollah, Hamas, and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. The commander of IRGC's Al-Quds Force, General Ismail Qani, visited Lebanon twice to attend the meetings. The Palestinian factions were provided with data about the movement of the Israeli occupation military, which frustrated the enemy's plot to ambush the Palestinian fighters near the Gaza border. According to the editor-in-chief of the Lebanese daily Al-Akhbar, Ibrahim Al-Amin said, "Had Israel expanded its aggression, the entire axes of resistance would have confronted it." Amongst the other support from Iran is funding, weapons and training. In 2020, Al Jazeera broadcast revelations from Hamas about the weapons being supplied by Iran. The programme What Is Hidden Is Greater showed members of Izzeddin al-Qassam Brigade, the armed wing of Hamas, collecting Iranian Fajr missiles and Hornet anti-tank shells. The Islamic Republic of Iran stands fully behind the Palestinian faction and is central to the wider axis of resistance.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He also co-founded and is a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. Our guest expert today is Sami Ramadani. Sami is an Iraqi-born lecturer in sociology, and he writes on Iraq and current affairs of the Middle East. He's also a member of the steering committee of the Stop the War Coalition. Sami was a political exile from Saddam's regime, but he actively opposed the US-led sanctions on Iraq and campaigned against the invasion and occupation of his homeland. Welcome to the show. David, what can you tell us about United Against Nuclear Iran, and should we listen to their assessment, do you think?
Well, United Against Nuclear Iran is one of the most pro-Israel think tanks in the US. Mm. I mean, it really should be registered as a foreign agent of the Zionist entity, but it's not. But it has on its board people who used to be the director of Mossad, and it's really quite kind of out there as a kind of extreme supporter of Israel. But nevertheless, they recognise that the role which Iran plays. And so, you know, it's interesting that even an organisation as ultra-Zionist as that is able to say something about how Iran relates to Palestinian liberation, and it's an accurate statement. Mm. And even though this is a hyper-Zionist organisation.
Well, Sami, I mean, tell us about the history of Iranian support for the Palestinians.
I think 1979 obviously is the critical year, because that's when the Iranian Revolution overthrew the Shah's regime. And the Shah's regime was a cornerstone of Israeli Zionist presence in the area. The Iranian regime under the Shah acted as Israel's main ally in the region. And the Iranian Revolution dealt a heavy blow to Zionist presence in the area, and put a halt, at least, to a lot of the aggressive policies that the Zionist leaders were planning in the region.
What does this daily coordination in Beirut tell us about the relations with the resistance and Hezbollah?
Well, I mean, the fact that they've got this daily war room where they're actually planning joint operations, not just between the Islamic Republic and the Palestinian factions, all of the factions, but also with Hezbollah, it shows that they actually conceive of the Axis of Resistance as being a functioning organizational body. And of course, it encompasses also groups in Iraq and in Yemen and in Syria. So, but it does show that there's an actual functioning Axis of Resistance, which effectively has its own governance structures. And that's an indication of the unity that there is now against the Zionist entity, and the fact that it's looking increasingly difficult for Israel to continue its activities.
Mm. I mean, Sami, I mean, can you explain what this term Axis of Resistance means?
It obviously evolved after the Iranian Revolution of 79, and basically it includes the various Palestinian resistance groups, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and later, obviously, as states, this term became to include Syria, and some Iraqi organizations, as well as, of course, Iran. And nowadays, you can even include the resistance of the Yemeni people against Saudi aggression.
I mean, and the resistance, of course, is seemingly, from the outside, becoming more effective than I think it's been in the past. I mean, would you agree with that, Sami?
Oh, certainly. I mean, there were some decisive moments, especially within the context of the two arenas, and a third one, I'll explain that as well. The first is the presence of Hezbollah in Lebanon, which actually defeated the Israeli occupation forces and defeated new aggressions on southern Lebanon and on Beirut and Lebanon in general by the Israeli forces. So that these events, these great military victories, became axiomatic or extremely important to the development of resistance against Israeli occupations and aggressions. And the second arena is Gaza, of course, and Palestine in general. Or if you like, this is the first one because it preceded the resistance in Lebanon. And the heroic, incredible resistance of the people of Gaza, for example, Palestinian people in Gaza, is incredible because Gaza is just one big prison occupied by Israel, surrounded sea, land, and air by Israeli occupation, is quite a remarkable form of resistance. So this is and in the last, say, since 2011, there also evolved resistance within Syria against the terrorist organizations that attempted to divide and destroy Syria completely.
Let me just ask David a question, if I can, before we go to the next clip that we want to show you. I mean, I just wanted to ask you, David, I mean, what do you say to the people who've been claiming that Iran and Syria, for that matter, actually, are not really anti-imperialist countries at all?
Well, there's no purity in struggle. I mean, in reality, there is the imperial power, which is the US and its allies, and the UK and Israel, and there is the opposition to that. And the opposition to that is the anti-imperialist cause. And people say, well, they're not left-wing enough. They're not like Venezuela or Cuba. That's not anti-imperialism. But, of course, anti-imperialism has got nothing at all to do with the question of neoliberalism. It's a question of whether you actively are in supporting the resistance. And if you ask the resistance what they think, they say, yes, Iran is our ally.
Well, we'll just pause there for a moment, because we've got a report now about how the resistance in Palestine actually views Iran.
The commitment of the Islamic Republic to the liberation of Palestine is not metaphorical or emotional. It is a clear material relationship that can be traced through the statements of both friends and enemies. Those who question Iran's selfless support for Palestine need only review the statements made by the resistance factions themselves for clarity. The generous support the Islamic Republic has given Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad is well known. What is less well known is the support it has given to both Fatah and the PFLP. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, founded in 1967 by George Habash, has struggled long and hard for liberation from Zionist colonialism and achieved some considerable victories. Just 21 years ago, the PFLP carried out the assassination of the highest-ranking Israeli minister by any Palestinian group throughout the struggle. The Israeli Minister of Tourism, Rehavim Zeevi, was tracked to a hotel in occupied Al-Quds and liquidated by PFLP operatives. The action was taken in response to the Israeli murder of PFLP leader Abu Ali Mustafa. As Talal Naji, the PFLP's Secretary General, revealed in an interview, Iran supplied all the Palestinian resistant factions, including Fatah, with weapons transported by ship. Naji claimed that while many know about the famous Karine A ship, which was stopped by the Israeli from transporting weapons to Fatah, most do not know about the 9 other ships that got through. He then asserts that in order for the factions in Gaza to develop their own means of resistance, the guidance of the late Qasem Soleimani was vital in developing the methods through which the factions produce their own rockets. Prior to this taking place, Naji makes clear how limited the capabilities were. The training to develop these means would take place in the Islamic Republic, Syria, or Lebanon under the supervision of Qasem Soleimani. Talal Naji states it was Soleimani who personally oversaw the delivery of the Kornet rocket, a Russian anti-tank missile, to Gaza. These rockets allowed the resistance to shock the Israelis by destroying their Merkavat tanks in 2009. Talal Naji later added, were it not for the principled support and positions of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the victories of the axis of resistance in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Yemen would not have happened today. Israel has consistently accused the Islamic Republic of supporting Palestinian resistance factions as if it was a bad thing, guilty as charged. Despite relentless conspiracy against it, the axis of resistance still stands.
Sami, you touched on this a little bit in your previous answer, but I just wondered if you could give us a brief outline of the different Palestinian factions that were mentioned in that clip we've just watched.
The two, if you like, historically most important organizations that appeared on the scene in terms of organized resistance. The very first one was Fatah, which was, it started military operations in 1965. First January 1965, in fact. So Fatah became the largest resistance organization, followed closely later on by the establishment of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. And there are other organizations, obviously, but the most important addition to these groups was the emergence of Hamas in the early 80s. As a military and political force. And Hamas gradually grew and became much bigger, and Gaza became the center of activity and organization, and its leadership emerged, or rather consolidated their presence in Gaza. So if you like, these are the three most important organizations representing various political trends within the Palestinian people, but with a common objective of liberation of Palestine and of continuing resistance. Sometimes there are tactical differences about forms of resistance, but there is broad agreement, strategic agreement about the liberation of Palestine and resistance to Zionist occupation and aggression. And these organizations had various levels of relations, whether with Hezbollah or with Iran or even with Syria, because Syria for a few decades, actually, Damascus was a major center for supporting Palestinian resistance. And although it became obviously the Syrian state became heavily involved to protect Syria itself, and let us not forget that Syrian lands are also occupied by Israel, the Golan Heights, very strategic, very important area of Syria. So you have an emergence of commonality of interest against Israeli aggression and occupation, and Iran became a major ally of that scene.
Yeah. David, I wonder whether you could say, or indeed, what you make of the Secretary General of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, Tal al-Naji, what he said in that segment. I mean, what do you make of that?
Well, I mean, it's perfectly clear, isn't it, that that all of the factions are being supported by the Iranians. It's not just the one which is perceived to be closest to them, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, but all of the factions. And it's also clear that there's much more in the way of support going on than isn't publicly known about. So sometimes we see ships are seized or materials are stopped. But clearly there's lots of other material which is getting through, yes, by sea, but also by land as well. So there's clearly a massive operation going on there, and the Israelis have been a bit surprised and shocked by that sometimes, and especially in the Unity Intifada of last May, where they were preparing for a ground operation and ground invasion of Gaza, and they discovered they couldn't do it, and they pulled back, and there was a ceasefire. So there's a real balance going on here, which people perhaps don't realise.
Interesting, yeah. I mean, Sami, it's not well known that Iran also armed Fatah, is it? And what do you think that says about the wider policy of the Islamic Republic towards Palestine?
I think, as I mentioned earlier, because it dates back to 1979, and in 79, Fatah by far was the largest Palestinian resistance organisation, and their leader went to Tehran straight away. And from there on, they built very, very close relations between Fatah and Iran. And Iran, as soon as they could, started supporting materially Fatah. And later on, the PFLP, and later on, Hamas, and later on, Islamic Jihad, which is a much smaller organization within Gaza. But in recent years, it has become much stronger force, and perhaps ideologically very close to Iran as well, more closer than others on other issues to do with the religion, to do with the perspectives about resistance and revolution and so on. But broadly speaking, all these organizations, and centrally Fatah initially, was quite an important link between the Palestinian people's struggle and Iran, as expressed by the then Fatah leaders themselves and the Iranian leaders too. So it's a broad scene, and it indicates as well that Iran has a certain political, ideological position on Palestine, yeah, as well as a religious perspective and so on. But in terms of the broad political approach, they regard Palestine as central to the struggle of the peoples of the region, as well as the Iranian people themselves, that yeah, the arena of Palestine is vital for the struggle of the Iranian people themselves and their struggle for independence. Remember, I mean, Iran is such a massive strategic state in the whole region, and this state became independent of U.S. domination in the region. And yeah, U.S. dominance.
Let me just move on to David now, because I just want to get David's thoughts about a recent interview, the leader of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, commented that Hamas receives a lion's share of Iran's support to Palestinians. I mean, I wonder how you think that might confound expectations.
Well, as Sammy was saying, I mean, both Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad are later on the scene than the previous organisations, more secular organisations. And Palestinian Islamic Jihad is much smaller. But it's perceived as being much closer to the Islamic Republic, and therefore people, I think, imagine that they get almost all of the aid that the Iranians get. But no, on the contrary, it's Hamas which gets the bulk of the aid because it's the largest military force. But what we see, I think, increasingly, is a kind of blurring of the lines between these different factions. And with the recent attacks that there have been and the recent activities that have been in the West Bank, especially the appearance of the Lion's Den and various other Palestinian resistance groups, you see even groups, fighters from Fatah, involved in the Lion's Den, along with fighters from Palestinian Islamic Jihad or from Hamas. So there's a real sense in which those lines of difference are blurring.
Mm. Very briefly, Sammy, because we're almost out of time, I just wonder whether you could say what price you think the Islamic Republic pays for its steadfast support for the resistance.
I think it's a massive price, really, to be accurate about what's going on. The Iranian state has been subjected to massive opposition from imperialism led by the United States and regionally by Israel and some of the Arab regimes as well. So one of the main reasons why the United States and Israel are so opposed to Iran and try to punish Iran is the stance on Palestine. So one of the most important reasons for the sanctions, for example, is support for Palestine, and by extension as well, support for Hezbollah in Lebanon, which is an anti-Israeli force, support for Syria, because Syria's lands are occupied by Israel, and Israel supports terrorism in Syria. Also within an Iraqi context, Israel and the terrorist groups are extremely active within Iraq. They use Iraqi Kurdistan as a base against Iran. So on many fronts, the Iran is paying a heavy price, but they are proud of it at the same time. Politically, they say this is our politics, this is our ideology, this is how we want to conduct
ourselves. We're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid, Sammy, because we're right out of time. I'm really sorry. We could go on for a lot longer, but I'd like to thank our guests today, Sami Ramadani, and of course our resident expert, Professor David Miller. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
The Limelight.
European Union ministers have recently sought ways to curb immigration and send more people away. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT noted countries that refuse to accept their nationals back after they are turned away from the EU will face visa restrictions, the bloc's interior ministers warned recently. They urged the European Commission to take action as illegal immigration to the EU reached its highest level since 2016. Support for restricting the number of visas granted to non-cooperative nations is strong among EU member states. Swedish Minister for Migration Maria Malmer claimed after a meeting of interior ministers recently. She said, "We see irregular arrivals increasing. Returning those who are denied asylum to Europe is a very important issue. the current level of returned migrants is not acceptable. Just 21% of 340,000 illegal immigrants refused asylum in 2021 were returned to their countries of origin, according to Eurostat data referenced in the meeting. If the political and diplomatic efforts to improve cooperation with third countries do not produce the expected results, the member states call on the Commission to come back with proposals on visa restrictions, the Swedish minister continued. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen agreed that there is a need to intensify the return of illegal migrants, calling for a pilot project that would bounce failed asylum seekers back from the bloc's external borders, with